From ACB Radio Mainstream, welcome to Tuesday Topics. For the next hour, we will be discussing a topic of interest to blind and visually impaired people. And now, from Miami, Florida, the host of Tuesday Topics, Paul Edwards.
Good evening. I am Paul Edwards in Miami, Florida, and welcome to Tuesday Topics this evening. I'd like to thank my producer, Brian Charlson, and I'd like to thank our very cooperative and immediately amenable recorder, Steve Bauer, for making changes at the last minute. So thank you so much, Steve. We appreciate it. And of course, George Byes of Talking Community, without your software and your support, we would not be able to do what we are doing. I would like to express my appreciation to all the folks who make Tuesday Topics happen. Tonight we have a guest from the American Foundation for the Blind, Mr. Mark Reichert, or Rickert, who is going to talk with us about a process called an NPRM for Titles 2 and 3 of the Americans with Disabilities Act. We wanted to record this program tonight so that it could be broadcast next week, so that those of you who are going to rush out and make comments on this NPRM will have enough time that you can listen to this program and get some ideas for those comments, and so you'll also know something about what an NPRM is. That NPRM comment period ends on August 18th, so it really is important that after you listen to this program, you get on the stick and start writing some comments. But Mark, if you would, let's begin with the basics. First, if you could, welcome to Tuesday Topics, but tell us what in the world an NPRM is, and then, if you would, tell us what Titles 2 and 3 of the ADA are, and third, tell us what the ADA is. There, you can do all of that in 2 minutes. Mr. Reichert, welcome to Tuesday Topics.
Thanks, Paul, and it's a pleasure to join you, and I hope this is informative for everyone who's able to tune in, as it were, and listen. Look forward to our question and answer period here, too, because I think that'll be of most help, I think, to everybody. First of all, an NPRM stands for Notice of Proposed Rulemaking. It's one of a gazillion acronyms that those of us who live inside the proverbial Washington, D.C. beltway get to play with. A notice of proposed rulemaking is basically the formal way that a federal agency, U.S. government federal agency, initiates the process of issuing rules, federal regulations. It's the way in which the federal government announces what it intends to do in terms of implementing a law, establishing a new program, fleshing out details about how it intends to implement certain provisions of law or to manage a particular program or priority in the federal government. There's all kind of rules that govern the process of a notice of proposed rulemaking or NPRM. Basically, what happens is that the notice is issued. There's an opportunity for public comment. Very typically, it's a 90-day public comment period. That's by far the most common comment period that's allowed, and that's an opportunity for members of the public to offer written comment, and by written we mean yes, on paper and also electronically, thank goodness, reaction to them on the U.S. Department's attempt at refreshing what are basically now 16-year-old regulations that implement two main transportation related issues, and then Title III has to do with public accommodations, so a hotel, restaurant, theater, library, etc., places more often than not, retail outfits, etc., and also so-called commercial facilities. Quite frankly, most of the comments we're going to be talking about tonight will really pertain to Title II, state and local government, and Title III, public accommodations.
Excellent. So now everybody knows what we're talking about. Now, my understanding is we probably ought to talk about one other acronym before we move on, and that is that one of the major purposes of this NPRM is to propose the adoption of the 2004 ADAG, So people will understand how everything fits together, you could tell folks what the ADAG is.
Sure. The ADAG stands for the ADA, or Americans with Disabilities Act, Architectural Guidelines. This is a very complicated, involved, if you held it in your hand, it would be a pretty substantial size document. Lots of details about physical accessibility-related requirements. One of our colleagues likes to talk about that the ADAG is a set of basically federal guidelines that establish minimal accessibility requirements having to do with everything about a building. If you took a building and shook it, would be covered. It's a bit of a idea. The ADAG has gone under several different revisions or updates over the years. And what they do is they say, well, some sections, you know, should we retain this requirement? Should we amend that requirement? Should some of these requirements be advisory in nature and not be, quote-unquote, out-and-out standards or mandated requirements? So that's essentially what the ADAG is. And in 2004, the Department of Justice asked for very specific reaction to changes that the smaller federal agency known as the Access Board, some of you may be very familiar with, proposed. And so that earlier rulemaking sets the stage for this one, and maybe we ought to just leave it at that, because it starts to get a little bit more involved the more we start talking about it, actually.
Yep, I think so, too. So some people will say, but after all, this is just regulations. Is this really a big deal for folks who are blind? I mean, everybody's making all this fuss about making public comments. And I mean, these are just regulations, right? What's the big deal?
That's a very important question to answer. I would say that the Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA, you know, it's a statute, it's the law of the land, but it sets basic guidelines. It's a little bit like saying, the law says, thou shalt not kill, but nobody knows exactly what that means, and you need to be able to define what does it mean, is it appropriate, under what set of circumstances. If you kill someone by accident, is that punishable the same way as you, punish murder? It's that kind of thing. That's really, regulations are where the rubber meets the road. It's not just the commandment or the law, it's exactly how you go about implementing what Congress has said. So, for example, Congress has said their stores, the things that they offer to everybody, in a way that folks with disabilities can access it. But the Department of Justice is what's responsible for coming along and saying exactly how it is that a public accommodation needs to do that. And there are a number of opportunities that all of us have this time around to make comment to the department on some of the things they've asked to change in the rules, and some things, frankly, they failed to do that will be very, very important to people who are blind or visually impaired.
So let's take the store example as one. Under Title III of the ADA, which is the area that covers stores and that kind of thing, one of the big issues is we who are blind think that entities that are web-based, that is, entities like Amazon.com, are covered by Title III. But do we need to tell the Department of Justice that? I mean, do we need to reiterate that belief? Is this the kind of thing that we're talking about that we could, for instance, make public comments on?
I think it's imperative that we make comment on it. The law is a little murky when it comes to applying these kind of federal discrimination requirements of the Americans with Disabilities Act, non-discrimination requirements of the Americans with Disabilities Act, to websites. It seems pretty well settled that where a store like Target, purely hypothetically speaking, is operating both a store and a website, that both the store and the website need to be accessible to folks with disabilities. You got to be able to get into that physical store, and you also have to be able to navigate Target.com when you are able to purchase things off of Target.com. So this area of the types of examples you've sort of alluded to by Amazon.com, these places that are web-only establishments. You know, the ADA is very physical disabilities oriented, that, you know, we don't have for people who are blind or visually impaired something comparable to that funny thing called the ADAG, that has to do, and maybe we ought to, you know, frankly, we don't have anything like that, that it elaborates for the general public and for people need access to the web. And by the way, these web-only establishments need to be accessible.
Yep. So that's a good example of one of the comments that maybe a lot of us ought to make in our own way. Talk about examples of websites that we've tried to use that are businesses that we can't get into, and say to folks, well, you know, I can't get into that website and I'd really like to use it. And by the way, is it imperative that everybody use a lot of legalese and legal language in terms of putting together comments, or is it okay just to kind of talk to DOJ as an ordinary person?
By all means, I think everybody at the Department of Justice who are these brainiac pinhead lawyers like myself, at least pinhead anyway, I'll leave the brainiac to all of you, I think they would very much appreciate having straightforward, non-legalese kinds of comments. The only thing I would say is that the shorter and less precise, if you will, your comments are, be sure to keep them very, very focused. I wouldn't do, for example, a short and sweet statement that said, please improve this stuff for blind people. As compelling as that might be and have be morally right, it's not gonna cut it for us. So I would say don't worry about having the most sophisticated set of comments, but short and sweet non-legalese is great, but make sure that it is focused. So even if you had a one or two line thing that said, you know, hey, there's more and more things that are going to the internet only, and I'm afraid that without greater protections, we're not going to be able to use those online-only services as blind people.
Another approach that the NPRM takes is to ask a lot of questions. Is it a good idea for us to answer those questions? Well, let's take an example. Under Title III, one of the questions that they ask, or in fact there are a whole series of questions about things that are called assembly areas, and these include stadia, and these include theaters and all kinds of other places, and there are a bunch of questions on physical accessibility, but there are also some questions which, for instance, talk about whether in a stadium it's appropriate to provide captioning for just emergency information, or whether in fact it would be a good thing to provide captioning that is close to play-by-play. Do you think in looking at a question like that, it's appropriate for us to start talking about, hey, wait a minute, if you're talking about sensory impaired folks, what about making information available to folks who are blind and visually impaired who are going to those assembly areas?
I think that any individual consumer is concerned about access for folks who are blind and visually impaired, who spots an issue like that, ought to make it known. First of all, there's no harm in raising, your question is not a harebrained idea, but let's assume that someone had one. There's no harm in raising any kind of concern or issue that's outside of the scope, if you will, of the questions that they do ask. I think there's any number of things that we're going to want to say to the department that they aren't necessarily asking. You know, for example, they ask a question here, should the Department of Justice require that all new films in movie theaters have be accompanied with video description? And I think all of us would answer amen, absolutely. You know, where can we sign? They aren't asking other important questions about what the concept of effective communication truly means and what it means to be effective, so long as the communication is effective. Well, no one has bothered to really flesh out what it means to be effective, and some of us are saying to the department, for heaven's sakes, let's make the standard be much clearer. Let's talk about the fact that whatever is done to accommodate us, we need to make sure that that we receive the same timeliness of delivery of that information, that it's as accurate as what's available to other people, frankly, that it's as thorough as what's available to other people, and that it gives us, frankly, the same opportunity. I said it recently, you sit in a doctor's office waiting room and you're asked all kinds of questions, and you know, it's pulling teeth to be able to get the kind of recognition that, gosh, you know, maybe I don't want to talk about appendicitis or, God forbid, you know, something worse than that. thing in here that reflects our concerns, by all means, raise them. Raise them in terms of an example of something you've experienced, and even if it's just a quick one sentence that says, and therefore I think we ought to have stronger regulations that ensure that I can do the same thing everybody else does privately and independently, that would be a good thing.
One of the things that seems to be happening with this round of proposed rulemaking is it would appear as though the Department of Justice is using terms like safe harbor and also, in some areas they're questioning whether they want to implement certain components. How would you advise us to respond to those kinds of things?
It's a tricky one. I think for you and me and other individual consumers, probably the best way to respond is to say that we find those kind of safe harbors objectionable and that the department ought not to do them. Let me give you one example. There is the proposed regs suggest that small businesses, and there's a special definition for which ones qualify, that small businesses that spend up to 1% of their gross income in a given year for the removal of physical barriers should be essentially given a get out of jail free card. Essentially, they should be presumed to be in compliance and given a pass. Unfortunately, these proposed rules don't say anything about how you go about making sure that the ramp that gets put in or the attempt at trying to make the bathroom stalls appropriately sized, whatever, are effective. In essence, all they really suggest is that the covered business produce, receipts or demonstrate that they've spent the money. But there's no real test that's at all meaningful for figuring out whether or not the accommodations that they have or the money that they have spent has actually been effective. So there are a lot of things like that. There's some language, for example, in Title II related proposed regulations. Again, that has to do with state and local government, that talk about whether or not courtrooms need to be accessible. Should there be accessible attorney areas or witness stands? Again, they're thinking about this in terms of physical accessibility primarily. And by the way, I should be careful to say that small business exception I was talking about, comments that say, for heaven's sakes, this law has been on the books for 18 years. We've had regulations for 16. Businesses and state and local governments have plenty of notice about what they need to do, and let's not talk about how we need to let people off the hook. Let's start focusing much more on compliance and enforcement.
I guess the one other issue that I'd like to raise about all of these safe harbor provisions and these blanket approaches, I guess I have trouble understanding how you apply those if what you're dealing with is a civil rights law, where at least in theory it would seem to me what you're looking at is testing whether an individual is being discriminated against. Doesn't this kind of blanket approach kind of go against what would seem to be at the heart of a civil rights law, which it would seem to me ought to be making decisions on an individual case-by-case basis?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no question that it does. I think that from a certain perspective, people will say, and we've heard this quite a bit from a number of folks who've been appointed by this president, whether it's at the Department of Justice or the Department of Education or what have you, a lot of the laws we think of, most of us anyway, I would hazard to guess, as civil rights laws that should be enforced along the ways you're talking about, these folks see as markedly different from, let's say, the 1964 civil rights law that has to do with, non-discrimination against folks on the basis of race, etc. Unlike that, where folks cannot be denied service on the basis of something like the color of their skin, from a certain political point of view, people will say, well, right, but these laws that you're talking about, guys, are laws that require businesses and so forth to do certain specific things, to actually go out of their way to do separate things for you. It's not like the traditional, if I can put it that way, civil rights laws that simply require folks to refrain from excluding you. Obviously, we would argue, well, yeah, but if you don't modify your business, your approach to how you do business, you are in effect excluding us. And by the way, the technology exists and all the rest of it to make it, and it's fairly readily achievable to do, if you'll forgive the expression, Paul. I think it cuts both ways, but I don't think there's any question but that these sort of one-size-fits-all blanket kinds of approaches that you're pointing out, yeah, they absolutely do cut against the idea of these laws being, as we would like to think of them, in the mainstream of civil rights legislation.
I can ask two more questions, and I'm going to open it up for other folks to jump in. So hang loose, folks. The first question that I want to ask relates to Title II. And it concerns a question that the NPRM raises, one of the few, and by the way, that's one of the things we need to be concerned about, one of the very few that seems to relate to folks who are blind and visually impaired, and that suggests that it would be okay to allow state and local governments to make some decisions about how they communicate with folks, and that we shouldn't leave so much individual choice up to folks under Title II in terms of how they get materials in accessible formats. What do you think of their proposal there?
I don't believe, Paul, that I can share with you that this is somewhat a family program, but suffice it to say that there are a lot of things about what the department has proposed in this rulemaking, in this NPRM, that would set us back, allow folks with disabilities the same access to the courts like everybody else. And in this case, I think we have an example where we've had a law on the books since, 1973. It was initially passed, the Rehabilitation Act. It was amended in 1977, I believe, and regulations, of course, as some of you know, were a long time coming, implementing that law. We all think of the Rehab Act as a state and local government entities that receive federal financial assistance and programs that do need to be accessible to folks with disabilities. And because that law has been on the books and those regs have been on the books for so long, the understanding has been, right up until the present day, that state and local government entities need to honor the individual preference of a person with a disability for the kind of communication that is most effective for him or her. That kind of honoring of the preference of the individual is not present in Title III, which has to do with, like as I said, public accommodations, hotels, restaurants, whatever. And if that preference language or that preference notion is not in that Title III area, because that was new in 1990. But under Title II, state and local government-related provisions, state and local governments and entities that receive federal financial assistance have been required to make accommodations and to address the communication needs of people with disabilities literally for decades. And the idea that the Department of Justice would come along now and try outrageous, especially when all of us know that we can point to examples where, even with the understanding that state and local government entities should honor the preference.
So the last question that I want to ask is kind of the $64,000 one, and that is to say there isn't very much in here about blindness and blind people. What should we do about that? If there's not a lot here, can we actually say to the Department of Justice, hey guys, you got lots of stuff in here about wheelchairs and lots of stuff in here about other disabilities and even a fair amount of stuff about deaf folks, but there's not an awful lot about blind folks. Can we actually make suggestions to them about alternative approaches that we think are the same sorts of things as apply to folks in wheelchairs? Well, let me give you a specific example. Supposing we're talking about assembly areas and stadia, and there are special wheelchair seats. Well, there may need to be special seats, say, for partially sighted folks who need to be close to the field and who need to have a clear line of sight. Can we actually, in our comments, say, hey, you're asking questions about wheelchairs, but what about us blind guys?
Yes, absolutely. The short answer is yes. I think that's imperative. I think another good area for us to comment on would be in the area of equipment accessibility. You know, the department specifically says in this notice of proposed rulemaking, you know, guys, we're not going to deal with the issue of equipment accessibility. We are going to assume that our existing regulations cover it. I mean, they say that out and out and in their rule, and I just think that that's outrageous. What we ought to be saying to the department is, you know, you've got some rules on the books here that talk about accessible paper cup dispensers, for heaven's sakes. If you can do that in that category, let's talk about needing it. Access to electronic and information technology. Let's talk about making sure that a fitness center that's a public accommodation needs to be accessible, that it's the equipment that folks use needs to be accessible. We can use any examples that we wish from our daily lives, but I think your fundamental point, Paul, is absolutely right on the money. At rock bottom, our comments need to be blindness specific because, frankly, nobody else is going to do it. And we need to be saying to the department, hey, this is a missed opportunity. You didn't deal with websites that meet our needs. You didn't deal with equipment accessibility. And what that really, really means, whether it's in a public forum like a stadia or a doctor's office, these are the kinds of issues we need to be raising and frankly, making them respond, which they're going to have to do if we raise comments like that.
From ACB Radio Mainstream, you are listening to Tuesday Topics. If you have comments about the show or a suggestion of a topic you would like to have discussed, send a message to TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. That's TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. Once again, the host of Tuesday Topics, Paul Edwards.
All right, let me open it up for folks to ask Mark questions, because I've been dominating things so far. So try to keep your questions short. Remember to tell us who you are and where you're from. And let's see who gets in with the first question.
Dave McElroy, Visalia, California. Good evening. And I just want to comment and thank you, Mark, for reminding me that I have been an avid participant at my local gym. I still am. But none of that equipment is accessible unless I have a sighted person, you know, which fortunately that particular gym is you know, they'll do it for me. But I do believe that there's a real problem within the exercise community, within the exercise equipment manufacturing community. There just isn't any available equipment that I am even aware of that exists. And all they'd have to do is add a speech chip to the thing, and it just isn't there. We need this kind of thing, and I, for one, plan on writing specifically with that request in mind.
Thank you for that comment. You know, there are a couple of things that we can say to the department that they ought to suggest or require in their. One of them would be to simply say, to mention, even just to mention, the need for especially Title III entities, hotels, gymnasia, libraries, fill in the blank, that their equipment needs to be accessible. Maybe this will surprise some of you, maybe it won't. You would look in vain in the federal regulations for anything really specific to equipment accessibility. In fact, the Department of Justice says in the sort of the intro to its proposed rule, you know, we considered addressing equipment accessibility, all different types, computers, exercise equipment, what have you. But, you know, we think that our existing rules are good enough. We don't really think we need to mention your stuff. And I think having, frankly, an out-and-out just, you know, deluge of comments that say that kind of attitude is why blind people have the kind of second-class access that we have under the ADA, you know, and we ought to be talking about that more. So even just raising that generally, I think, would be excellent.
Mark Anisi Correa from Atlanta, Georgia. Thanks so much for your remarks are really on target. You mentioned earlier before when you were describing ADAG, as far as architectural barriers, about the fact that it doesn't really deal with blindness and perhaps we should have our own ADAG. And could you elaborate a little bit more on that and what would it take? And would that address some of our needs and put the emphasis where it needs to be?
Well, that could be a whole series of Tuesday topic discussions, I imagine, but I'll take a crack at it. Probably the closest thing that blind and visually impaired folks, and not just us, other disability groups have, to an information access kind of related ADAG, it has to do with Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act. And I don't want to get really into that theology here too much, but suffice it to say that there are provisions that have to do with what the federal government is required to do to make electronic technology it purchases accessible. And there's a whole lot of standards related to that. Not only that, not only the technology that it buys or develops, but also what it means to make websites that the federal government operates accessible.
Remember that in talking about equipment access, we really need to look at Title II and Title III. Under Title II, you have places like colleges and universities, which have things like fitness centers, and you have cities that have parks, and cities that have fitness centers that are made available for their employees, and a range of other things. Now, clearly, we need to be sure to indicate in our comments that we're not only interested in Title III folks, where they might be able to argue that there's not as much obligation, but we're also interested in being sure that equipment is accessible under Title II. One of the things that I will probably include in my comments is I work at a college where at the moment none of the students who are blind or visually impaired are able to use any of the vending machines in a group because they've gone to vending machines that use nothing but touchscreens and touchscreens that are too sensitive to be labeled in Braille. And so essentially, my folks can't buy drinks and know what they're getting, which is a scary thing and ought not to be allowed. And that's the kind of example that we're talking about that you can use. Don't go far afield. Use your daily life. You guys run across inaccessible stuff every day when you're out in the community. But think about state and local government. Remember that it's not just businesses that you need to be concerned about. Let's then go back to the question that Mark was answering that related to Anicio's question about another ADAG.
I think the closest thing we have to an information access related ADAG is the Section 508 related guidelines, which has to do with what federal government entities purchase in terms of electronic and information technology, computers, whatever, cell phones, all the rest of it, and also what they have to do to make their websites accessible. And what I was saying before I got disconnected is that the Department of Justice could have said the Section 508 related regulations should be a starting place for evaluating, for example, how to make websites accessible. When I came back in, Paul, I know you were emphasizing the state and local government piece, and I think that is very, very important, especially given that under Title II, the state and local government stuff, the Department of Justice is suggesting to not allow the individual's preference to rule the day. So, I mean, I think we need to be thinking about that. Ironically enough, the Department of Justice has already, in years gone by, issued guidance to state and local government entities on how they can make their websites more accessible. They could have done that. The Department of Justice could have done it with respect to Title III, and they just are acting as though the Internet doesn't exist. And although some of us might be frustrated with the Internet this evening, I think we recognize that, you know, it's a pretty important thing. And the idea that they don't even mention it at all in their Title III rules is just really kind of astonishing.
This is Dave McElroy again. One of the things that I think of when you talk about not having a choice in communication is the fact that in my employment of 25 years, one of the reasons that I worked where I did was because I happened to be able to speak Spanish, and that was a commodity that was wanted. And people who did not speak English as a first language had the option way back in the 70s to say, we want to be communicated to in our own language. It seems to me that to deny that to us to deny that to any disabled individual is to deny a civil right that has become commonplace. And that, to me, is a very, very scary thing. And I wonder if I should mention that as well in my response, Mark?
I think it's an interesting, ethnic minorities, any kind of, frankly, protected class and group that could be singled out for unfavorable or unfair treatment.
Yeah, this is Pam Drake in Visalia, California. Is there something that we can say or a parlance that we can use to, I want to say, force them? Because I know we got to, and I knew this, so we do have to watch our language, believe me. I respect what you said about it being a family show. There's a few words that might sum it up very succinctly, but beyond that, is there anything we can say that would cause them to realize that they are not, if you will, cross-referencing their regulations or their proposals one against another, and that some titles are being given appropriate treatment and others are just being totally ignored? Why not in Title III if you're doing it in Title VIII? And of course, and two and three if you're doing it in Title VIII. And of course, you could say that if they start to backslide on these later provisions, they could just as soon decide that everything is going along hunky-dory in Title VIII as well. I mean, do we want to use words like blatant disregard, or is that too strong? What can we do?
Well, I can see you're ready to take words. I think Paul said it earlier. Practical examples. This is what I am facing in my daily life, in terms of what when I've tried to access state services, government, to use that equipment, and somebody's failed to frankly even go to take the simple step of putting some basic labels on even the start button, so I know how to operate or at least get the machine going. I mean, it's those kind of specific things that I think the more that we give them, and frankly, this is a numbers game. It's not, you know, going to be as important as I know the folks at the American Council of the Blind and us at American Foundation for the Blind would like to think our comments are. Believe me, it's not about that. This is about getting as many human beings into the department as possible with even a short and simple statement that says, hey, you forgot about blind people. What about equipment? You guys need to be addressing equipment access. You guys need to be addressing web access for me. You need to be addressing effective communication more directly. And we haven't even talked about service animals tonight, but that's certainly something that people are really excited about, because that these rules do actually try to tighten up the definition of what a service animal is. And I think there are a lot of people in the broader disability community, I think, that want to have that language expanded.
Hi, Mark, this is Joanne with Techway Dome Tiles out of Tucson, Arizona. I'd like to know what your understanding of the rulemaking is with regard to detectable warnings. The research that we have done indicate that essentially they want to just pull it except for areas at transit stations, which we feel is a huge step backwards for your civil rights and that of all of the blind community.
Yeah, I agree with you. I hope folks heard her asking the question about detectable warnings. This has been something that's been kicking around for a long time, and this rule adds insult, this proposed rule adds insult to injury by, you know, essentially saying we said what we meant what we said, we're only going to allow a requirement for detectable warnings on platform edges, we're not going to deal with it in other, you know, pedestrian rights of way, and that's just something that we need to be very, very clear with them that we're not pleased about at all.
Thank you. I just wanted to verify that. We want you to know that we absolutely are completely devoted to servicing the blind community with our detectable warnings. We actually go and confer with orientation and mobility folks to find out what they want. And I think a lot of this is driven primarily by the commercial industry that doesn't want to spend the money to put it down, so they're lobbying to sort of have that taken out. I think that's in large part because there is a huge amount of product out there that simply doesn't hold up, so it relates back to maintenance issues, durability issues, and actually things that are not even remotely compliant with the current ADAG standard. So we have actually manufactured a high-tech concrete detectable warning that is 100% durable, 100% non-slip, and 100% compliant. If we could get more pressure or guidance with the rulemaking to keep the detectable warnings, we need to start actually enforcing those guidelines and kicking manufacturers out that create things that, do cause these kinds of issues to come up.
Joanne, thanks very much for that comment. I think the real bottom line here is it is ironic to me anyway, and maybe Mark will want to comment on this, maybe he won't. But it's ironic to me that one of the very few things that is directly related to blind and visually impaired folks, one of the few things that was actually there, is now essentially being taken away, and really for no good reason. There haven't been fundamental complaints about the fact that they don't work. There have been some issues about whether they hold up. But it seems to me that stronger regulations that specify more the kind of durability testing that's required will ensure that we end up with something better. But I would absolutely urge everybody to say that accessible warnings are extremely important, not only on the edges of platforms, but in dangerous street crossings where there's essentially a blended curb, in areas in front of dangers like fountains you could fall into, and a range of other things of that sort, accessible warnings can be really effective and appropriate for many of us who are blind and visually impaired. You know, having some accessible warnings at the tops of stairways is not a bad plan either. Mark, I don't know if you want to make any final comments on accessible warnings before we open it up for the next question.
No, other than give you a big hearty amen to what you just said, Paul.
Hi, this is Bob Hache. I'm going back to a very basic accessibility, which is accessible documents, something that we sometimes get and sometimes don't get. I'm wondering what exactly the ADAG says, if anything, about accessible documents, and if they've proposed any changes, and if you could speak both to Titles 2 and 3 on this one. Thanks.
Well, under Title 2, there is an expectation, or has been up till now, that the state and local government entity would honor the preference of the individual with a disability for the kind of, you know, way they want to be talked with. And, this proposed rule specifically says, as we've already said tonight, they want to back away from that. They want to explicitly open this up, this idea that maybe we don't need to honor the preference of the individual, which is just outrageous. Title III, there's never really been a recognition that the individual's preference, what do they want, what type of format, what's appropriate. There's never been a recognition that you have to honor the individual's preference. However, Title III, just like Title II, there is an expectation that communication be effective with people with disabilities. And we need to talk to the department very clearly about what effective communication means and what it doesn't mean. And one of the things that it absolutely must mean is that it allows us the same degree of privacy and independence that is available to everybody else who receives the communication. That's something that hasn't ever been spelled out before, and though, saying that by use effective communication, and it's going to be timeliness of the delivery of the communication, accuracy and thoroughness of the communication, and allowing the same opportunity for privacy and independence as everybody else has. And if that means providing documents in accessible format that meet our needs, then that's what has to happen. At least that's the way I would hope we'd urge the department to implement this rule.
Mark and Paul, where do you, or on the websites, both for the ACB and the AFB, will you list exactly where comments should be sent, and maybe give some parameters for those comments with regard to detectable warnings? And could we actually assist you with something like that? And then secondly, I was talking with the Access Board, and they actually encouraged people to ask for an extended comment period with those comments.
I actually think the extended comment period is a good idea. I don't know that we'll get it, but one of the things that certainly some folks have indicated is that there is some pressure to try to get this whole issue completed before election time. I certainly don't have any absolute evidence that that's the case, but it's certainly something that we can conjecture might be a situation that we're dealing with. I don't see any harm in asking for comment periods to be extended. 60 days is unusually short. Usually comments for NPRM are 90 days, and especially given communications issues, I think it's a good plan to have those things available. In the document that I sent out via email today to everyone on this list, there actually is a link that will take you directly to the documents that you need to read that are available both in PDF and HTML formats. And in the case of the first two documents anyway, you can also, from Adobe Reader, save them as text files, which would then be easy to translate into Braille, or which you can read on some note takers even as text files in grade 2. So getting to the documents isn't too difficult, and the specific places where you send the comments are right at the beginning of each of those two documents, so that it'll be pretty easy for folks to find out where you need to send your comments to. We will also be publishing on all the other ACB lists lots more information or lots more reminders for people to send in comments, and we'll be telling you then where to send them. So that should be pretty easy. Would you like to add any more to that, Mark?
Sure, only that we have published a summary of some of the things that we've talked about tonight, suggesting not only some of the issues we want to discuss, but also some of the ways in which we can respond. And you can find that at the AFB website, www.afb.org. And specifically, if you want to go to the policy page, you'd go to afb.org/gov, G-O-V, dot A-S-P, as in Alpha Sam Papa. And there's a summary up there, and it also gives you a specific link, which if you use that, you'll be able to go right to the page on regulations.gov that allows you to type in your response or any comments that you might have to these regulations.
That's excellent. The other thing that I would encourage people to do is to go to one other website, which is www.dredf.org. That's D. R-E-D F. Am I getting that right? Let's see. Disability Rights Education Defense Fund. Yes, DREDF.org. And there are a lot of comments that are available there. Don't ape them. Think about how those maybe auto-apply to blind people. And they're good comments to read because they've made a lot of comments, and a lot of their comments are actually pretty interesting. It won't hurt us to reiterate some of their issues and then ask how some of the issues that we're reiterating for them apply to them. Our guide dog users group has actually sent in some comments already with regard to service animals, and you know, if you've got a dog guide user who's a friend, they can certainly probably send you those so that you can see what they look like. Just keep your eyes open, and I think over the next few days you're going to see a lot more comments that are actually out there that you'll be able to get to. Mark, one of the things that came out of the ACB convention this year were a couple of ADA-related resolutions. One of them concerned access to Stadia, and the other concerned the ADA itself. If you're familiar with those resolutions, and you should be since you were on the resolutions committee, can you tell us just a little bit about them and whether they have any relationship to this NPRM?
Well, sure. The first one on Stadia, I will. We've got at least one person in this group I know that will forget more about that resolution than I'll remember at this point. The gist of that was essentially to say, look, if we're going to be talking about access to not only appropriate seating at Stadia, but also information that's related to other people, well, let's make sure that blind and visually impaired folks aren't left behind and are treated effectively the same as other folks with disabilities and treated fairly. The second resolution, a gentleman by the name of Paul Edwards, I think, did an excellent job of crafting a very strongly worded resolution having to do with the ADA generally and making sure that when we talk about, you know, we always like to say, in the same way that I think, you know, we listen to other groups of folks with disabilities and they're feeling pretty frustrated too. But in our case, we keep getting told, oh, your issues are dealt with just fine in existing provisions, yet we know that they're not. So hopefully we can take these kinds of resolutions, and I know the final text of them, I think, has just been recently completed, so folks can distributing those to the membership so you can use those as a guide. They'd be other excellent sources for us to use in developing our own individual comments.
This is Pam Drake again. Do we have an overlap with the telecommunications issues that we've been discussing, and if so, can we cross references? Can we comment on this?
The telecommunications issues that you're referring to are a much more technical and have to do with requirements that the law would impose on businesses or entities that aren't really covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act. So they are related. There's overlap in terms of the kind of need that we have, but it's not redundant. Here's a good example. These rules, proposed rules, ask the question, should there be video description in theater? Well, the telecommunications or technology-related legislation we've been pushing specifically talks about putting back in place that TV video description rule that got thrown out by the courts some 6-7 years ago. This rule wouldn't touch television, but it would certainly get to the issue of making video description more widely available in theater. But we obviously want both, because we want to be able to make sure that description is available both in theater and on TV. So there's a relationship in the sense that they tackle different parts of the problem, but there isn't a redundancy or an overlap in that sense here.
I think I'd just like to reiterate, and I think it sort of rides on the back of that answer, is that especially with respect to the focus on detectable warnings and that just being just taken away, it really needs to be, so many people need to get involved and get out there and get active with getting these comments in. And then when we know that we've got the things that are absolutely being addressed right here, continuing to go after them to continue to improve all of the civil rights for the blind community.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that, Joanne. Mark, let's talk about a couple of other kind of specific areas. We've talked about a few things under Title II. We've certainly talked about the need for us to be concerned about at least raising the issue of equipment access. We've talked about the need to be concerned. One of the big areas that the department's gotten involved in is to talk about playgrounds and play areas. There aren't a lot of provisions that were in EDAG that relate to making play areas accessible to blind and visually impaired folks. Unfortunately, there probably could have been a lot more, and maybe that's one of the comments that we can make. But one of the concerns that some of us have is it seems as though there is a suggestion that we ought to cut a lot of slack to play areas. That's an example, that there are some others, but in terms of play areas, should we give the Department of Justice that? Should we say, okay, we'll cut you some slack, play areas don't need to be accessible?
I'm not in any mood to give them any slack on anything, but I would say that all of those kinds of things, play areas, recreational kinds of issues, I mean, nobody else, here's the bottom line from my point of view, nobody else is discussing equipment-related issues. Nobody else is going to be discussing effective communication-related issues. Nobody else is going to be addressing web accessibility issues. I mean, I think a short and sweet one-sentence thing, if we really wanted things with respect to physical accessibility that just are rolling the clock or turning the clock back, I think that's all we need to say. But for my money, I would want us, if I could be king for a day, I'd want all of us to comment on those things I just flagged a second ago, because frankly, nobody else is going to talk about it.
Anyone have another question for Mark?
Hi, it's Bob Hache. I know this isn't necessarily blindness related, but I thought it might be beneficial to the group to hear a little bit about a scary concept I heard about called safe harbors. And also the idea that DOJ is looking for comments in terms of cost-benefit analysis with places like courtrooms where they don't think it's a big deal if a witness can't get up on the witness stand and has to testify from a lower point of a wheelchair and things like that, and how they're really looking to get rid of some of that and turn the clock back on it.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. I mean, I guess what I would say is I think that it is important that we say that we think that attorney areas and witness stands need to be accessible. And I think we can say that to be making sure that they're able to access the court system. In the case of Title III entities, we need to be saying to the department, and with respect to playgrounds and other things, by the way, if you're providing equipment that has on-screen displayed information, we need to be able to make sure that kids can access that equipment. And we need to be raising wherever possible our particular spin, because nobody else is going to do it. Nobody else is going to raise the equipment accessibility or electronic and information technology type of issues. And we are frankly desperate for those kind of comments to be made to the department, because nobody else is going to do it.
That's excellent, Mark. So thanks to all of the folks who did manage to turn up tonight. We certainly appreciated having you here. Let me remind everyone that if you do have issues for us at Tuesday Topics, you can get hold of us by sending us an email to tuesdaytopics@acbradio.org. That's Tuesday, TUESDAYTOPICS, at acbradio.org. Let me also remind everyone that because of the timeliness of this topic, we've actually split our two-part program on litigation into two parts, and separated them by this NPRM program. We wanted to get this recorded and out there so that people would actually have an opportunity to get a better idea of how to do comments. So we felt that it was important for us to put this out there now. So not only tune in this week to this program, but please remember to tune in next week when you can hear the second part of the program that we recorded last week on litigation and folks who are blind, how it works and what it does. Thank you so much for being with us on Tuesday Topics. Remember, we need your comments. Blind people need to be heard. We're a relatively small group in the disability community as a whole, but we're powerful because we can communicate and we know what we want now, and we're going to get it. Thanks, everyone. Good night.
To participate in the recording of Tuesday Topics, we invite you to join us on Tuesday evenings in the U.S. at 9 p.m. Eastern. That's Wednesday at 1 hour Universal. The program is recorded in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. That's ourplace.acbradio.org. All you need is a microphone that is plugged into your computer sound card. A few minutes before each program begins, those who are online will be happy to assist with audio checks and to answer questions about the chat room software. An announcement about the show, including information about the topic and the guest speaker, will be emailed to the ACB Radio Friends List. So we hope you will come and join us each week on Tuesday, when Tuesday Topics is being recorded. We'll look for you in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. Tuesday Topics is a production of ACB Radio Mainstream.